This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, everybody. Richard Martin here with the wake-up call. It is bright and early on Monday morning for you, and it is the 15th of March, Monday the 15th of March 2010, and late at night for me here, and it's a very great pleasure to be with you once again to bring you the horrors of the world in glorious sound. I don't know about color. I think black and white would be more appropriate, but anyway... Let's go right in with the present state of the economy. More than 5 million homeowners are behind on their mortgages. There are over 6 million Americans who have been unemployed for at least 6 months. That's a record 40% of the ranks of the jobless. Almost 1 in 4, that's to say 24% of Los Angeles County residents are unemployed, and that is Depression-era statistics, ladies and gentlemen. The highest recorded unemployment was 25% in the Great Depression of the 1930s, and we're already 24% there in Los Angeles. The private capital stock is growing at its slowest rate in nearly two decades. Roughly 30% of manufacturing capacity is sitting idle. Nearly 19 million residential housing units, or about 15% of the stock, is vacant. One in six Americans is either unemployed or underemployed. Commercial real estate values down 30% over the past year. The average American worker has seen his or her level of wealth plunge $100,000 over the last 2 years, even with the recovery in equity markets this past year. Bank credit is contracting at an unprecedented 15% annual rate so far this year, as lenders sit on a record $1.3 trillion of cash. Unit labor costs are down an unprecedented 4.7% over the past year, and what has replenished household coffers has been the federal government, as transfer payments from Uncle Sam now make up a record 18% of personal income. And the Senate has just passed yet another jobless benefit extension bill. All right, this is Richard Martin. This is the wake-up call. The number to call in with your questions and comments is 888-873-4643. Once again, 888-873-4643. Please feel free also to email your questions and comments to the following email address, rm@gfawd.com. RM is Richard Martin, GFAWD is Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. That's Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, GFAWD.com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And then if you'd like to call me privately, the phone number to call would be 941, area code 441-1682. You do not have to call Singapore. You can call Sarasota, and your call will be transferred to me in Singapore. Once more, the phone number to call me directly is area code 941-441-1682. And I've been having quite a number of calls recently from people asking questions, and I hope that you're all getting the answers that you were looking for, even if they are not always what you might have hoped they might be. But at least I hope to put you on the right track, or at least what I think is the right track. All right, well now, last week, you may remember, I gave you an example of how statistics are mauled and just generally taken apart and thrown at you in the most dishonest, corrupt way imaginable, which is pretty much all the statistics that you're getting out of the government and big business these days. And I thought I'd just give you yet another example of how it is that they pervert these statistics so that you get used to the idea that even if you can't really analyze what might be wrong with the statistics, that you know that you have to take them with a pinch of salt. You have to be very circumspect about what you believe and about the kind of things that people are telling you, always, of course, with an optimistic frame of mind that may just be out-and-out lies put in place to make you think that everything's getting better and to spend your hard-earned money on things which are most likely to lose value way behind. So here, this one concerns last week's retail sales statistics, which according to many of the experts were unequivocally good news. This is a pleasant surprise, especially in the light of the severe winter weather across large parts of the country last month, said Ian Shepherdson, an analyst at High Frequency Economics. Consumers are beginning to come out of their shells. IHS Global Insight analyst Nigel Galt said, today's data suggests that real consumer spending will rise from about 3% in the first quarter, the fastest increase in 3 years. As shoppers buck snowstorm to push retail sales higher, according to the Wall Street Journal, this is consistent with the trend we've been seeing, said Accenture's Chris Donnelly. We've seen a gradual thaw in the consumer pocketbook, and there is pent-up demand. We are certainly in a more optimistic place in February 2010 than in February 2009. Retail sales beat expectations, according to CNN Money. While we are not expecting the consumer to come roaring back in the near term, improvements have been quicker than expected considering the still distressed state of the labor market, wrote Adam York, an economist for Wells Fargo Securities. This is more than a one-month wonder, said Stuart Hoffman, chief economist at PNC Financial in Pittsburgh. This is telling us that consumers who had been tightening their belts throughout the recession have now loosened them a notch. We needed the consumer to step up because that's the biggest part of the economy, said Sal Guattieri, an economist at BMO Capital Markets. February sales were surprisingly good, considering the snowstorms that blasted across the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic region, says Richard Jaffe, a managing director at Stifel Nikolaus and Company. Nikhil Nemira, a chief economist at the International Council of Shopping Centers, is more bullish. He sees the February sales numbers as the beginning of a cyclical recovery. I think the picture is overwhelmingly one of a retail recovery, he says. While he acknowledges that the sales increase is off weak 2009 numbers, he is nevertheless optimistic. A broad retail recovery is in play, he contends. There is a fair amount of pent-up demand, and we're only seeing the beginning of that. A hopeful economic sign, February retail sales jump, according to Time. Well, if they had dug even a tiny bit deeper and tried to understand the factors that contributed to the increase, as the authors of the following free exchange post, Good News No Match for Bad News, have done, they might not have looked so out of touch with reality. The news organizations are trumpeting new retail sales data out of America. Here's breathless Bloomberg on heroic American shoppers. Sales at U.S. retailers unexpectedly climbed in February as shoppers braved blizzards to get to the malls, signaling consumers will contribute more to economic growth. Kind of makes your eyes well up a little, doesn't it? But of course, every silver lining has a cloud, and this one seems to have a rather dark and foreboding cumulonimbus. February retail sales were up, but only because January's sales were revised down by about $1.5 billion. Absent the revision, the February numbers would have constituted a decline. Meanwhile, over half of the year-over-year increase in retail sales in February is attributable to purchases of gas. Recall again that oil prices have essentially doubled from this time last year. And then there's this. Engaging the economic recovery's trajectory, you shouldn't forget that this is not a normal tax season. People who don't pay income tax are getting an extra $30 billion in refundable tax credits thanks to the Recovery Act. The Joint Committee on Taxation has estimated, based on the timing of tax refunds in past years, well over half of that has likely been paid out already. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Economy.com, said the extra serving of tax season cash to modest income families, quote, helps explain the somewhat surprising strength in retail in February, end of quote. And excluding AMT relief, Zandi figures peak stimulus hits this month or next. This was a stimulus, remember, that was well short of Christina Roma's $1.2 trillion recommendation, which was itself computed based on data that underestimated job losses by about 1 million. Well, if that's not enough of a dark cloud for you, then there's also the fact that consumer confidence fell in March for the second consecutive monthly decline. Recovery looks more uncertain by the day. Okay. Well, lately we've heard about some very deep and searing corruption that has hit the skids with the latest Lehman fraud, and here's an example of some of the corruption that indicates what these people know and how it influences them in their policy making today. I think we need to focus on the Federal Bank of New York's culpability in the apparent Lehman fraud. That is, the role that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and thus Tim Geithner, who was the head of it at the time, played in keeping an insolvent institution afloat through the use of fraudulent artifices. We must first look to what the PDCF, or Primary Dealer Credit Facility, was created to be. The report does this for us. Under the PDCF, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York would make collateralized loan to broker-dealers such as Lehman Brothers. Now, pursuant to the Federal Reserve Act's requirement that a Federal Reserve Bank lend only on a secured collateral accepted by the PDCF, initially consisted of treasuries, government agency securities, mortgage-backed securities issued or guaranteed by government agencies, and investment-grade corporate municipal mortgage and asset-backed securities priced by clearing banks. So that was the collateral that was agreed to be placed in the hands of the Federal Reserve in return for cash. Well, the problem is that broker-dealers used the PDCF not as it was intended and announced, but rather as a scheme to post illiquid or even trash collateral that nobody else would take in exchange for liquidity, that is, cash. When they ran low on cash, they then tender that trash to the Fed for a TAF or a PDCF loan. These blatant violations of the Federal Reserve Act were not only tolerated, but cheered whenever Wall Street needs more slop for its pig trough at your expense. Ladies and gentlemen, the point here is not to dwell on the rights or wrongs of this action, but to indicate just how hopeless the situation was, and that Geithner, and by association the administration, have been well aware of the futility of the situation since the very beginning. And as Barry Ritholtz points out, the latest bankruptcy report on Lehman is both revealing and damning. Once again, the investing public learns, after the fact, the basic truisms of modern markets. Major accounting firms are worthless to investors. They were either unable or unwilling to detect fraud amounting to $50 billion. The incompetents at Ernst & Young deserve the same fiery death as Arthur Andersen. Whether they are hired guns or paid whores, they, like the rating agencies, are worthless to investors. Corporate management engages in fraud all too regularly. Am I reading this correctly? That Dick Fuld's defense will be, I didn't know that Lehman was a giant Ponzi scheme, and I was unaware that we were hiding billions in bad debt and leverage off balance sheets. Based on the release of the bankruptcy court report, Lehman was technically insolvent perhaps years before it collapsed. The short sellers turned out to be the good guys. Considering the absurdity and fraud of protecting the banker frauds from the truth as revealed by Einhorn, etc., the SEC is utterly incapable of comprehending how markets function. They believe the criminals who committed the fraud and ignored the whistleblowers who uncovered it. The ban on short selling that they've just announced is an indictment of the inability of the SEC to understand what is going on, and a reward to the criminal corporate management teams. The media did a terrible job uncovering the fraud as well. Sub-media folk were used by CEOs. Some of the TV press who relied on access to their subjects actually rallied to the defense of these CEOs, including Fuld, who trashed the short sellers. Most notably, Charlie Gasparino from his CNBC days, but there were others as well. The analyst community, for the most part, failed as well. The few who publicly did acknowledge the debacle were notable for being so far outside of the herd, 95% of them were wrong. Pathetic. All in all, the entire system failed. The situation is utterly disgusting, and if the investing public pulls its money out of the completely corrupt public markets for a generation or more, it wouldn't surprise me. You know, we talk about rating agencies downgrading the U.S. debt. They should have done it a decade ago. Why? Because we continually call the debt-to-GDP ratio as somewhere between $12.57 trillion and $14 trillion, right? Or 89.8%, while ignoring the claimed amounts of the Social Security and Medicare promises. But unless you're going to tell Granny that she's not going to get her check for health care, along with the 80 million boomers, all of who will instantly vote out anyone who tries to tamper prolong the agony that much longer, I have no idea how or when the final solution will be made apparent, but you will not want to be in the United States when it does. The social consequences will be unspeakable. So what's the real debt-to-GDP ratio of the federal government? Well, if you believe Carl Denninger, about 500%, if one assumes the forward liabilities are on the low end of CBO and private estimates, or $60 trillion. This makes the total debt $72 trillion and the ratio 514%. No nation has ever managed to pull that off past the point of recognition of these costs. And the reason is simple. Interest. Compute the damage that, say, 5% interest imposes on $72 trillion and you blanch immediately. That's $3.6 trillion, by the way, or more than our entire federal budget. We get away with not paying that sleight of hand, effectively playing option arm and adding to the principal. But all option arms have a recast point. We're just not sure where this one is. Once the recognition point happens, the decline in all asset classes becomes both relentless and instantaneous. The power of self-delusion is powerful, but it cannot overcome the math, not in the long term. You know, this is the kind of thing we've been talking about on my Sunday discussion shows. The idea that those in power know these things perfectly well. They know that there's not a snowball's chance in hell that these debts will ever be paid back. Yet they go through the gruesome motions of adjusting the economy and allowing financial companies to lie about their balance sheets so as to kick the can down the road and pass it all off to someone else. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as I'm sure you are aware, the longer we go on with this, the longer I and the more I bring your attention to these things, the more evident and apparent it will be to you why I am proposing that you make arrangements to leave. Now, I know that most of you will not do this, but I am getting echoes from people who I think would have not given me the time of day 2 or 3 years ago, and that are beginning to take all this very seriously indeed. And you should do. Well, very soon we're going to come up against a break, but, you know, the Post-Crisis World Institute Foundation surveyed 247 economists, consultants, business leaders, state officials and journalists in 53 countries, asking their opinion on their vision of the global economic development. The survey covered specialists in various fields who analyze and understand the current situation and have influence in decision-making and shaping of public opinion, explained Mikhail Polikapov from the Post-Crisis World Institute. A quarter of the experts surveyed preferred not to be named, especially in China, which is evidence of discrepancy between the public and the official position, said Yekaterina Shipova, the director of the institute. She said she was amazed at the pessimistic sentiments which appeared common among intellectuals worldwide. And I quote, "A geopolitical redivision and a multipolar world forecast imply war." End of quote. There is the concept of a self-fulfilling prophecy, which means that the more people share an apprehension, the more chances it has to come true, she warned. Well, I've said this before, I'll say it again. The United States cannot afford to keep troops in 140 nations. It cannot afford to keep fighting wars that do not need to be fought. It's time to declare the war in Iraq won and leave. It's time to declare the war in Afghanistan won and leave. The Afghanistan war is no more winnable than ever Vietnam could be. It's fiscal conservatism which is needed across the board. If Congress is unwilling to raise taxes to pay for a program, then that program should be scrapped. We can start by scrapping HUD, the Department of Education, then we can scrap the Department of Energy, and also get rid of all the crop subsidies and allow imports of drugs from Canada. The amazing thing is that Obama says he doesn't want deficits, Republicans say they don't want deficits, and Democrats say they don't want deficits. So why are there deficits? When Obama says, even offhand, that the United States is out of money, he's talking nonsense, dangerous nonsense. And the natural instinct is to wonder if he even believes it. I mean, he knows it very well, but he also knows there's nothing he can do about it. When he released his new budget proposal on February the 1st, he asserted that the government, quote, simply cannot continue to spend as if deficits don't have consequences, as if waste doesn't matter, as if the hard-earned tax dollars of the American people can be treated like monopoly money, as if we can ignore this challenge for another generation. Well, you know, I think he does believe that. I said that on the show this last night for you. But I think that he knows that there's nothing he can do. He knows that this situation is hurtling towards financial Armageddon, and he just has to play the part. He has to go through the motions. And quite frankly, I don't know what those motions will lead to. I think they won't necessarily lead to the end game in his administration, but they'll come very, very close. I think he will be a one-term president, and I think the next president's job will be even worse than Obama's. But make no mistake, the next election process will be pockmarked with people promising absurdities, making comments just like have always been made about things which can't possibly happen, and the American people will be left in this terrible conundrum of choosing between two incompetent people, neither of whom understand the vaguest bit about what's going on. It's a very, very serious situation. And as I've said on my Sunday shows, there is no solution. There's no way out. And I don't think people understand that. Yet, they will, and they're coming to understand it, and there's more being written about it, that the politicians are completely clueless, and those who really matter in the administration are very well aware of what's going on. The sociologists are telling them. I mean, I get my information from some sources, and those sources are available to everybody. They're not just available to me. And the sociologists are very well aware of what's going on. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I think it's time for our break. I will be back in a few moments, and we shall continue where we left off.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Helen Kamai, co-host of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Dr. Eugene Zamperone and I have been deeply involved with indigenous cultures and combined traditional knowledge with the latest research in natural health care. Join us each week on PRN from 1 to 2 p.m. every Monday. We'll bring you authors, professors, researchers, and activists who are committed to bringing you the latest information which you can use to ensure maximum wellness for yourself, yourselves, and your family. Tune in to Progressive Radio Network every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time or anytime by visiting the archives. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hotel with Sierra Club Radio. Tune in Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to hear interviews with green authors, activists, politicians, celebrities, and more.
Stephen Lindman hosts the Progressive Radio News Hour Saturdays and Sundays, as well as currently on Thursdays, as an antidote to government and corporate propaganda on the most cutting-edge world and national topics. Distinguished guests are regularly featured to provide commentary and analysis impossible through the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation and what Project Censored calls junk food news. The Progressive Radio News Hour airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Okay, I've got two book recommendations for you this week, ladies and gentlemen. The first is called The Big Short by Michael Lewis, and it describes not so much the meltdown itself, but the players and the machinations that went on behind the scenes at the time of the meltdown. And as a matter of fact, the review that I'm going to talk about is by Felix Salmon, and who describes this particular book. And this is Felix Salmon, by the way, and he is a very distinguished and able commentator. He describes this as, and I quote, probably the best single piece of financial journalism ever written. So can't get much better than that. Anyway, on January the 30th, 2007, Jamie Mai wrote an email to his partners, Harvey Leddy and Ben Hockett, quote, if a broad range of CDO spread starts to widen, it means that a material global financial crisis is likely occurring, end of quote. On January the 31st, 2007, one day later, a broad range of CDO spread started to widen dramatically. The long-feared meltdown was upon us all, not that most of us knew it at the time, and a very small number of investors was about to get paid out on the trade of their lifetimes. Mai, Ledley, and Hockett were part of that select group whose tale is grippingly told by Michael Lewis in The Big Short. The Big Short is not the story of the crisis, as the crisis is commonly understood. The failure of Lehman Brothers and of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the stock market crash, the bailout of Detroit, the fevered all-nighters pulled at Treasury and the New York Fed, the fears that in the entire global financial system was on the brink of collapse, little of that, if any, is in this book. Instead, Lewis has found a different story, one which he started mining for a spectacular cover story in the December 2007 issue of Portfolio magazine, and which has culminated in this book over 2 years later. And I actually pasted the article at that time in my email list for my readers, ladies and gentlemen. I happen to remember that. It's the story of what used to be called the subprime crisis before it metastasized into something much larger and more dangerous than that. And it's also, like all Michael Lewis tales, a human story which takes us deep inside unique characters like Steve Eisman and Michael Berry. On the face of it, there's almost nothing sympathetic about these men. Their social skills are all but non-existent. They live in a world of arcane financial analysis which might as well be a different planet for all that it has bearing on the way that most of us live our lives. And they made their outsized profits by wagering hundreds of millions of dollars on the proposition that Americans across the country would end up being thrown out of their homes after they found themselves unable to make their mortgage payments. What these men did was not socially useless, to quote the chairman of the UK's Financial Services Authority, Lord Turner. It was worse than that. It was actively harmful. Since they provided the fuel which kept the subprime mortgage furnace burning, even when the country was running out of new junk mortgages to write. In most financial markets, bearish bets act as a dampener. In this one, they were a necessary part of the subprime mortgage machine, and a Deutsche Bank mortgage trader named Greg Lippmann ended up making billions of dollars for his employer, not to mention a $50 million bonus for himself, by aggressively going out and finding fund managers to put on the short bets needed to keep the market ticking. This is the same Lippmann who, when accused of being a Chicken Little, responded by saying, "I'm short your house." But Lewis has a soft spot for these misfits, fund managers who stumbled into the bond market from careers making bets on stocks, who suffered ridicule and ostracism even from their own investors before their bets paid off, and who he has now chosen to immortalize in print as the few clear-eyed men in a world of deluded bankers and investors. At the same time, Lewis aims both barrels at the rating agencies, happily quoting someone describing the staff there as basically like brain dead. He also sets up a hapless fund manager named Wing Chao as a major villain for taking the long side of the bet and making millions of dollars by doing so, despite being spectacularly wrong. The result is a rollicking narrative, a tale of beleaguered little guys betting against monster banks and fund managers, and in the end, winning. Lewis barely mentions the biggest and most famous of the shorts, John Paulson and Andrew Lardy, perhaps because they were too rich and successful to begin with. Amazingly, despite the fact that the book is so one-sided, it also functions as a peerless guide to exactly what went so very wrong in the credit markets generally, and the mortgage markets in particular, over the course of the last decade. It's not easy to explain synthetic subprime-backed collateralized debt obligations, but Lewis does an excellent job on both the micro level, what these things are and how they worked, and the macro level, how the market in such exotica helped to destabilize the entire financial system. Most impressively, Lewis has backed up his story with an enormous amount of old-fashioned reporting, spending a lot of time with the characters in his book and their families, as well as getting the important complex financial details correct. Not everybody will understand the grittiness of the details, of course, that's inevitable, but everybody will be gripped by the book's narrative all the same. The portfolio story on which this book is based was a great tale which was sometimes a bit fuzzy on the finance. The book is an even greater tale with the facts nailed down. The result is that rarest of beasts in a world drowning in financial crisis books, a new book which actually breaks news. For instance, Lewis uncovers what could possibly be the single greatest trade that any Wall Street banker ever made. In December 2006 and January 2007, Deutsche's Greg Lippmann paid an insurance premium of 0.28 percentage points to take out insurance on $4 billion of AAA-rated bonds from Morgan Stanley's Howie Hubler. Less than a year later, that $11 million bet paid off to the tune of a whopping $3.7 billion. I'll save you the math. That's an annual return of more than 33,000%. There's lots more where that came from. This is an assiduously reported and beautifully written book. There aren't many reasons to be happy about the global financial crisis, but here's one: that it brought Michael's book back to his roots to produce what is probably the single best piece of financial journalism ever written. Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Not much better than that. Again, the title of the book is The Big Short by Michael Lewis. That's L-E-W-I-S. Okay, well, that's one. And the second, oh, by the way, please feel free to call. I don't know, we're not getting much by way, in fact, anything by way of emails today or calls. So do please try and do your best. Call in, write in, let's have some feedback. Okay, here's another book recommendation. The book is by Vicky Ward. It's called The Devil's Casino, Friendship, Betrayal, and the High Stakes Games Played Inside Lehman Brothers. This is a fascinating book about Lehman Brothers, and basically the lead into its final demise. So, Lehman Brothers, the oldest partnership on Wall Street, was always a brilliant but cursed child. Its life and death tells us why it was a magnet for talent and why it was toxic. There have been a slew of terrific books on how Wall Street brought the economy to its knees, but in The Devil's Casino, Vicky Ward does something unusual. She takes the reader inside, not just inside the financial instruments, but inside the culture that sired them, inside the families, including the spouses and children that enjoyed lavish riches, and inside the internal rivalries and management that speeded the fall. Readers of this remarkable tale do not stand outside looking in, their noses pressed to the glass. We are inside looking out. We feel the seething greed and jealousies, the stuff that makes novels come alive. In the end, the child dies, but because of the way Vicky Ward unspools the saga of Lehman, its life and death will both instruct and forever sear your memory. Well, that's from Ken Auletta, author of Googled, The End of the World as We Know It, and Greed and Glory on Wall Street, The Fall of the House of Lehman. The Devil's Casino tells the riveting story of the four best friends who rebuilt Lehman Brothers, vowing to be the good guys of Wall Street, only to find themselves corrupted by the poisonous culture there. With its illicit affairs, treachery, seances, boardroom backstabbing, and friendships and families torn apart, the book reads like a page-turning thriller. Who would guess that the story of life at Lehman would turn out to be even more dramatic than the firm's headline-grabbing, economy-shaking demise? And that comes from Arianna Huffington, co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Huffington Post. The Devil's Casino is a totally compelling, true story, deeply researched, but as exciting as a thriller, the almost mythical saga of four friends destroyed by money, sex, and ambition, with a cast of greedy, larger-than-life Wall Street monsters and an intimate history of the fall of Lehman. As exciting and important as Barbarians at the Gate, it's a gripping portrait of American society and financial culture that explains much of what is happening today. I can already see the movie. That's from Simon Sebag Montefiore, author of Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. The Devil's Casino is more than a history of Lehman Brothers. It is the saga of four friends who are prepared to sacrifice everything, including each other, in the quest for money and power. The devil here is not in the details, but in the souls of the men who lost their moral compass while looking for the corner suite. Vicky Ward has written a superb social history that should serve as a warning and a reminder to all who work on Wall Street. From Dr. Amanda Fordman, author of Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire. There you go. Some interesting reading for you, ladies and gentlemen. Let's hope that you enjoy it. All right. Well, Last week, if you remember, I started talking about a fascinating take on the disturbance of equilibrium, which permeates all of life. Unfortunately, we ran out of time, so I thought I'd try it again. It's an unusual take on the breakdown of the economic apparatus, but it certainly, I think, follows the laws of nature rather well, and so I'm party to it. In chemistry, there's an experiment called the temperature jump, or T-jump experiment. It is known for its capacity to monitor the rates of very fast reactions, like enzyme-catalyzed reactions. You start with a system at equilibrium. Such a system might have a number of chemical species interconverting with each other, but they do so at rates that cause their populations not to change over time. Think of an analogy with a balanced ecosystem, highly fluctuant yet stable. In the T-jump experiment, you shock the system with a rapid pulse of energy. The system now has all the species at their original concentrations, but it is no longer at equilibrium because it is a new, higher temperature which changes their preferred populations. Using the ecological metaphor, you might think of it as introducing a new species to the mix. Following the fast perturbation from equilibrium, one can then watch how it returns to equilibrium under these new conditions. The analogous economic experiment might be a money jump or M-jump experiment. You start with an economy at equilibrium. Supply and demand are in balance. Providers of goods and services, stores, pharmacies, contractors, etc., are sustained by the inherent demand. The rate of production matches the rate of consumption. Of particular import, people have savings and debt, but they also have a firm grasp on the two. Debtors are acutely aware that some portion of their future output will be used to pay off creditors, and they have planned accordingly. Cash-depleted creditors can count on revenue streams to replenish savings. Inflation is non-existent in this utopian economy at equilibrium. To the extent that occasionally some clever soul finds a way to improve production, a modest price deflation, the good kind, would be expected. There certainly exists a positive gross domestic product, or GDP, goods are produced and services are provided. The corresponding net domestic product, or NDP, NDP equals GDP minus depreciation, would be fairly close to zero. For the most part, the economy produces what it needs and consumes what it produces. So here is the M-jump experiment. This economy's version of the Fed decides the equilibrium unemployment levels are too high for comfort, or even that the system could thrive even better. Whatever their motivations, the Fed decides to solve some real or imagined problem by simply adding money to everybody's savings overnight. They write stimulus checks. This jump in the money supply, this so-called M-jump experiment, represents a displacement from equilibrium. The economy didn't increase production of goods or services overnight, yet the average person, Joe Sixpack, feels richer. The monetary expansion associated with the M-jump produces an instantaneous gap between perception and reality. I am neither a nor economist, thank God, so I can only guess what they were thinking. We must assume the Fed is not just comprised of a bunch of fools. This causes the story to take on a fictional quality to the more jaded, but bear with me. One presumes they attempted to translate the perception of increased wealth into an increased capacity to produce goods and services. Recall the fundamental axiom of wealth: you grow it, make it, or mine it. The Fed is betting that the shoemaker, one of many Joe Sixpacks, buys a machine to produce shoes faster. The store owner purchases inventory software to decrease inventory costs. And the carpenter buys a new tool, maybe a pneumatic nail gun, to build houses faster. Of course, somewhere in the economy, somebody had to work a little harder than usual to produce these new tools, but hopefully there will be a disproportionate increase in output and commensurate improvements in quality of life. As the story goes, society either produces much more with a modest increase in effort, or produces the same with less effort. Both seem like admirable achievements. If you were a betting person, however, what would you think Joe Sixpack would do with the new money? Joe might buy a car, put a porch on his house, go to the movies, take a vacation, or even cut back on the long hours at work. Many of these behavioral changes, the increased consumption of goods and services, serve to decrease rather than increase Joe's output. Joe now consumes more and produces less. The increased demand for goods and services and decreased work ethic, however, causes the shrinking number of workers to charge more. Joe begins to notice rising prices. Whereas monetary inflation, the M-dump experiment, was instantaneously, price inflation lags and surfaces unpredictably. Over time, the money sloshes from the consumers and spenders to the shrinking population of producers and savers until the consumers start feeling less resilient. Of course, the consumers can borrow from the savers to delay belt tightening, but eventually they owe too much money and must cease consumption rather drastically. Curiously, the producers and savers find that their newly acquired wealth buys less than they expected as well. How disappointed must the savers experiencing muted gains be? In short, the perceived spike in wealth was an illusion. Because the displacement from equilibrium caused by the M jump prompted overconsumption and underproduction, it was destructive. The economy produced less overall, while the misperception of wealth flourished. People bought stuff they didn't need with money they didn't have. Families eventually felt poorer and tightened up their spendthrift habits. The producers and savers now find they are not as rich as they thought, forcing them to keep working. Eventually, the spenders and borrowers go back to working more and consuming less. The system begins to produce what it needs and only consumes what it produces. As this pattern becomes widespread, the Fed realizes their monetary injections caused the recession. They recognize their erring ways and stop intervening in free markets. Everybody lives happily ever after. What a delightful fairy tale. The reality, however, is that a huge gap between perception and reality, a large displacement from equilibrium, emerged over decades in both the U.S. and the world. Serial monetary injections by central banks to solve the problems du jour elicited more consumption than productivity. Nothing could be more emblematic, monuments to the malinvestment, than the McMansions built with leveraged finance. They are stone heads on Easter Island, but less durable. According to the physicist Carnot, it is impossible to perform a function and return back to the starting point without a net loss in energy. Unwinding malinvestment has a tax too. Unused goods and services are wasted human and natural resources. A modicum of understanding of physical science reveals something else. Large displacements from equilibrium produce systems that are shock sensitive and prone to violent and destructive returns to equilibrium. Think of bombs, avalanches, earthquakes, houses of cards, and, of course, credit bubbles. The global crisis is forcing the enormous perception-reality gap to narrow violently. At some point, we will regain our collective sense of what we have saved, what we owe, and how much we can afford to consume. Equilibrium will represent an alignment of perception and reality. The ongoing economic correction, the unwinding of malinvestments by a currently unknowable path, will, of course, cause pain. Okay, Well, we have Mark from New York who would like to talk about putting his house on the market. Hello, Mark. How are you doing today?
Hi, Richard. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Hello, Richard. Are you there?
Yes, Mark. Hello? Go ahead.
Okay. So, you were wondering why no one was calling today. We had a big storm and blackouts all over the area.
Oh, over really? Here. So oh, well, that's too bad.
I don't know how many listeners you have in New York. But anyways,
so much for global warming, Mark.
Well, it's climate change, but yes.
Climate change.
So my wife and I are putting our house on the market, and do you think it's, even if we don't make as big a profit as we might have if we sold it earlier, do you think it'd still be worthwhile just to get out of a house that you own and into rental?
Absolutely, 100%, I think. And now is really a good time because we are right in front of the next decline. And the next decline, of course, will come from the Alt-A and prime mortgage holders whose resets are beginning right now and are going to cause a most sickening decline in real estate prices, both domestically and also commercially. So, yes, I definitely think this is a good time to unload if you haven't, of course, unloaded already. I couldn't, more emphatic on that score, Mark.
Yeah, we're still ahead of where we bought it at, but it's getting close.
Don't let it get any closer. That's my advice.
Okay. I know a lot of real estate agents are in a hurry to sell before the April 30th deadline on that that credit people get.
Huh. Well, that's another reason to try to beat them at the game, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, yep. Do you expect the market to go down at some time, or is it just going to keep?
Oh yes, I think the market is right on the cusp of the edge of the next sickening and horrendous decline. The stock market will be the biggest loser of all from here on out. I'm looking at an 85% decline in the value of the market between now and the bottom of this thing.
Okay. Because I was watching the Japanese lost decade, and it looked like they had three or so bull markets during that lost decade.
Well, it's actually lost 2 decades, Mark.
Well, it's going on two. It's now two, yeah.
Yeah, it's 1990 to 2010. That's 20 years by my reckoning.
Yeah, it's a long time since I saw this Japanese movie when they were all taking over in the movie. And now
that's
look
right.
At it.
Well, you know, my sense is that the American market will follow the Japanese market down to the letter. It may take a little less time. It may not. It may take more time. The stakes are far higher in the United States than ever they were in Japan, and the sense of denial is as great as it ever was also in Japan. So, I think it could play itself out over, you know, years and years and years.
Yeah, that's one thing we like about selling the house is the possibility of leaving the country if ever we need to, rather than being tied down.
I think that would be a great idea. You don't even need to. You just do it because you feel like it and because it's the best thing you could possibly do. Couldn't support you more in that endeavor, Mark. Mark, we have a call, and we're running out of time here. We've got 5 minutes. We've got a call from Charles in Oakland who wants to talk about short sales. Charles, just before you talk, and thank you very much for your call, Mark, and I hope I've given you some helpful advice there. I just got an email from Bill Farmer who tells me that the Big Short was on 60 Minutes last night. You can get it on the archives of 60 Minutes on cbsnews.com. I won't read you out the actual whole address of it, but Bill, thank you very much indeed for the heads up. Ladies and gentlemen, you will be able to access it. I didn't know. I always used to watch 60 Minutes when I lived in the States, but I guess I'm going to have to go for my own archives here at some point and watch it there. I had no idea. This is absolute total coincidence. I had no idea that Michael Lewis was on 60 Minutes. Thank you very much for the heads up, Bill. All right, Charles, very quickly, we have about 5 minutes left. Charles from Oakland would like to talk about short sales. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Richard and listeners. Last week you had a caller or maybe an emailer that called in asking, writing about short sales. And there was one thing that wasn't mentioned, and that was the 1099 that follow a short sale, and that the IRS would anything, the amount that you short of the loan, the mortgage company would send in a 1099 as income, you know, on you.
And as income, yes. Well, I mean, that is that. I had my understanding was that the IRS was looking into that and was going to see if they would forgive that particular transaction. I never followed that through to its conclusion, but with the administration now actively talking up these short sales, I have a feeling that it will have to be accompanied by some leniency on the part of the IRS, because otherwise it's pretty meaningless if the wretched investor, or rather the seller, has to pony up the money. So that's a very good point you make, and I don't know, I'm not up to date on the latest developments on that score. Do you have anything to offer us here, Charles?
Well, the only thing I've come across so far, CPA was saying that insolvency may resolve the 1099 issue, but in order to be insolvent, you would have to, if you had refinanced the home, you would have to at least put half the refinance cost back in the home, and the home is still underwater, and you might be able to come up on a insolvency claim. But that's the only thing that I've heard so far.
Personally, I don't think this is going to work. I mean, so many of these homes were also encumbered with home equity loans. In addition, one wonders how they're going to be treated. I don't know that people who lent money on the basis of asset collateral in a house are going to look too kindly to see these short sales taking place under their noses. There's a lot of issues that have to be worked out as to, you know, whether this thing can fly. And my feeling is that it will not. That the difficulties and the basic confusion will be so great that they will not be able to design a way out that will enable these mortgage companies to go ahead doing and forcing them, you know, basically to go ahead and engaging in these short sales. I don't know that it will be feasible. I think it's an idea which just isn't going to fly. And that's my own assessment. Now we'll see what happens. But it's just another way of, you know, keeping the debt on the books of somebody else, namely the taxpayer. I mean, this is just nonsense of the first order. I have no idea how much longer this charade will continue, but there will be a solution somewhere, and it'll be a default and bankruptcy, and, you know, I have no idea where it's going to lead. We're treading on untrodden ground here, Charles.
Mm-hmm. And what's your topic for next Sunday?
Okay, I'm glad you asked. I think we've sort of done over the topic for the death wish of the United States. I think we're going to talk about the influence of the Internet and how it has really affected our lives and our livelihoods, because it's had a much greater effect than most people realize. People see the Internet as being a positive, and it is, of course, a tremendous positive. It's a revolution. But there's been a downside, and we need to talk about that, and we need to see, you know, exactly where it's gone. So we're going to talk about the Internet next week, Charles. For all of you who are interested, there we go. This is Richard Martin, and unfortunately we have come to the end of another show, and so I shall be with you again on Friday, same time, same place. Hopefully the weather will be better by that point, and that will enable people to make more phone calls. Anyway, thank you both of you for calling in. Charles and Mark, and I look forward to talking to you on Friday. Till then, bye-bye.